Hi there. Welcome to the From Lab to Launch podcast by Qualio, where we share inspiring stories from the people on the front lines of life sciences. Tune in and leave inspired to bring your life-saving products to the world.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to From Lab to Launch by Qualio. I'm Kelly from Qualio and your host for today. We're glad you're here. Today, we're interviewing two innovators on the front lines of life sciences and co-authors of a recent book we'll talk about and link to in the show notes. Dr. Eugene Lipoth has been called the Einstein of modern anesthesiology. He's a renowned board-certified pain specialist and a huge proponent of the stellate ganglion block, a minimally invasive procedure that has been proven effective in treating PTSD symptoms. Jamie Mustard is an artist and a renowned strategic consultant. He is the author of the best-selling book, The Iconist, The Art and Science of Standing Out. Beginning as a child and then into adulthood, he suffered years of trauma at varying levels before stumbling across Dr. Lipoth and the dual sympathetic reset procedure. We're going to dive into their groundbreaking revelation that psychological trauma manifests as a physical injury that can be seen and monitored on a brain scan, and their revolutionary approach to resetting the sympathetic nervous system that has helped countless patients suffering from chronic pain, anxiety, PTSD, and other related conditions. Let's bring them in.
So we usually only have one guest on the show, but today we're excited to have both of you here. Tell us briefly about how you guys got connected and then decided to co-author this book together.
You want me to go?
Sure. How about you?
All right.
You'll do a better job than I will.
I had to overcome a lot in life, literacy issues, parental abandonment from a very young age, the kind of trauma that most people don't ever come back from, quite honestly. I was very motivated by, that if I somehow got successful, if I somehow achieved education, if I somehow had affluence rather than poverty, that these would make all my problems go away. And I found that the more I achieved and the more I was kind of getting what I wanted in life, that the discomfort I was feeling was not going away. I started trying to look and figure out why that was. In certain ways, it was getting worse because now I didn't have an excuse for it. So I started searching, and through a series of fortunate events, I ended up meeting through a military trauma psychologist, who I shared a literary agent with. I met Dr. Lipoth, and transformed my life and the way that I moved through the world.
I love that story. Yeah, that's I think a lot of people carry these things around and then run into these walls, but just never connect the dots or figure out how to break through in that. So that just sort of fumbling around through therapeutic pathways. I mean, how did you come across that?
Well, 6 or 7 years ago, for the first time in my life, I'd achieved enough that I was never willing to look back. The only thing that worked for me was looking forward and being in complete denial that anything was wrong with me or that anything ever happened to me. I was in total denial. The worst thing one could possibly be, in my view of the world, was be a victim. So I was completely lying to myself that I'd ever been victimized, right? And so, but as I achieved and felt this great discomfort with achievement, I thought something's wrong. I'm not supposed to feel this way. This is supposed to feel good. So I went to see a therapist for the first time, and she diagnosed me with a complex post-traumatic stress disorder, which very much upset me. And I kind of laughed in her face when she said it. I mean, I just thought it was preposterous. And then she said, her eyes welled up and she said, "Have you been listening to the stories you've been telling me?" And my BS bullshit life narrative kind of fell apart in that moment. And I like to say I started hugging the cactus. Mm-hmm. And, it was very providential what happened right around that time. A forensic psychiatrist, and I was always leery of psychiatrists because I thought they just drug people but he was a fan of my other work and had reached out to me, and I'd heard about Dr. Lipov's work, and this guy was a really renowned forensic psychiatrist who liked my other work. So I said, "Hey, can you vet this for me?" And he did that. And he basically, there's you know, and basically what he came back with is, what's the upside? What's the downside? There was pure upside, no downside, no dependency on drugs, no mitigation where I'd have to be like taking something for the rest of my life, doing yoga every day for the rest of my life. You know, like this appeared to be a reset of the fight or flight system in the body, and there was no downside. So two and a half years ago, I braved COVID. I got on a plane with 8 people in the middle of COVID, flew to Chicago. It was like a sci-fi movie, and and underwent the reset of the sympathetic nervous system.
Interesting. And so just pulling from some of my own life and having been through some EMDR training, one question I had a little further down, but I feel like I should pull it in now, was talking about what the DSRP is and how it differs from other treatments for whether it's the anxiety and the...
Well, we call it DSR. Call it DSRP. We should bring the physician
here. Dr. Lipov.
Yeah, so let's... Okay, thank you. So first of all, it's not DSR. It's not DSRP. I don't know what that is. So DSR is dual sympathetic reset. So if you don't mind, let me give you the history terminology. Yep. You know, it's science-y. You can't have to be really accurate when it talks science-y stuff, right? So let's talk science-y stuff. So stellate ganglion block has been around since 1926. It's a procedure that's been done by famed physicians for many years, specifically for hand pain, burning pain, and other things, purpose pain, and stuff like that. So in 2003, I figured out that we can use that procedure to take away hot flashes. And then I published on that. So the critique of that procedure to me was, yes, it's working, but you don't know how it works. So it's total garbage. So that gave me a lot of encouragement to figure out why it worked for hot flashes. So in reviewing a bunch of medical articles, I came across an article where they did T2 clipping in the chest, which is fight and flight nerves are in the chest.
What's clipping, Dr. Lipov?
Clipping is putting a metal clip on nerve to turn it off.
Okay.
Basically, you have to push the lung out of the way and put a clip on a nerve, which is pretty good-sized procedure.
I was going to say, that's fairly invasive.
Right. And they found the hand sweats went away, but PTSD went away also. So I reviewed that literature. I was like, I had no idea why that would be. So I look at the literature. It turns out the nerve, sympathetic nerve here, goes to the bundle of nerves in the neck and up to the brain. So I treated the first patient for PTSD in 2006 and published on that in 2008. So kind of speeding it up, then military has adopted it. They've done it in a number of institutions that was replicated. I had a patient that was very severe PTSD. We did a procedure on him. And usually after the procedure, people feel significantly better 10, 15 minutes. So he's looking at me 40 minutes later. It's like, I'm still in a lot of trouble. And I had no idea what to do at that point because all I know is how to do that block. That's all that's ever been done by pain, people like me. I was pretty frightened, to put it mildly. I had to change my shorts after that day. but, you know, almost. Anyway, so before I got into PTSD ward, I was doing procedures in Norway. The government of Norway invited me to help them with hot flash treatment. So we came up with I learned how to do a procedure called superior cervical ganglion block, which is an injection higher up in the neck. So this guy was in a lot of trouble. I took him back. He was a sniper for the Marines. And I did the second procedure higher up. 10 minutes later, after he left, he was doing great. We followed him up 5 years and he was fine. So I was scratching my head because it's never been done. I was like, why would that be? So I looked up a book. It was called Stellate Ganglion Block by James Moore, published in 56 out of Princeton 72. But there is a very clear explanation. Turns out fight and flight nerves go from the chest up to the neck at C7, go up to the brain following vertebral artery, which is half the nerves. The other half goes up to the neck higher and goes to a different part of the brain following internal carotid artery. And that is why we're doing now DSR, dual sympathetic reset. We're doing two levels instead of one. And the reason it's called dual is obvious. Sympathetic because it's fight and flight system. Reset is because what I believe it actually happens, PTSD, what PTSD is, you have severe trauma or multiple small traumas that activates fight and flight system, or sympathetic in sciencey terms, as Jamie would say, and he got stuck in that position. So if he can reset it to pre-trauma state, like computer, if you have a computer and you have software problems, you put a patch on, but if the hardware is broken, it's not going to work, right? So what we're doing here is we do the hardware reset by doing the DSR, and then we can do psychotherapy following that. That's like software patch, and it seems to work best as together. So that's kind of a long-winded answer.
Yeah, the way you have to look at it is, you know, the book is called The Invisible Machine, right? And what the reason we call it that is you have to look at we've been looking at trauma as a disorder. It's not. It's 100% a biological injury, okay? And it's you could compare it to a broken leg you can't see. There's all these incredible therapies out there, from EMDR to talk therapy, to ketamine, to psilocybin. There's all these things. And but you wouldn't do physical therapy over a broken leg. And you and what's so important about it also, so all he's doing is resetting the leg, and then these other things become far more effective. You're fixing the hardware before you attack the software. If you're trying to fix... if you're trying to run software on a broken computer, it's not going to run very well. And also, you know, the concept of a disorder is incredibly stigmatizing, right?
It is.
Yeah,
it is.
And it's also not true, right? In 85 to 90% of cases, when someone gets a dual sympathetic reset, their extreme symptoms are gone. They're just a person again. And what's important about the relationship between the DSR, the dual sympathetic reset, and its origins in the select ganglion block, which was developed in 1925, 1926, it's almost been around for 100 years, is that we know that it's safe. And there's no side effects. There's nothing else that exists that can give someone so much space and so much room to then better and improve their condition that is experiencing fight or flight symptoms. In fact, you know, this work is really about Dr. Lipov and his innovation. Where I come into this is, you know, maybe as an amplifier using art and story to amplify his work, but also maybe I see his work from a different perspective because where I come from. You know, when he and I met, he's been somebody I have incredible respect for him because of how much pushback he's had over the last 20 years. How many people told him that he was wrong, even though it's now been public peer reviewed, published in massive, you know, major peer reviewed journals. The Army studied it, the Navy studied it, Barack Obama endorsed it back in 2008. The military is probably doing 15 to 20,000 of these a year. It's been on 60 Minutes. Good. You know, it's gotten very mainstream despite whatever pushback he's gotten. He's gotten incredibly far in 20 years. But when I first came across the work, I didn't see it in relation to the military. I didn't see it in relation to first responders or sexual assault victims, who are the biggest cohorts getting this right now. When I saw, you have to look at the symptoms of what fight or flight symptoms are, as Dr. Lipov describes it, as how you would feel if you were running from a tiger. Mm-hmm. If you were running from a tiger, you would be anxious. You would have mild paranoia. Is the tiger going to be here any second? You would have a sense of doom. The tiger's going to... You would not be able to relax. You'd be hyper-vigilant about the tiger. You'd be hyper-aroused because there's a tiger right around you. You wouldn't be able to sleep if there was a tiger chasing you. You would have a hair trigger. You'd be very reactive. Okay. And in the ultimate form of fight or flight, or flight in the military, where people are trained to protect, is suicide, the ultimate form of flight. And in the neighborhoods where I grew up, where violence is more acceptable towards each other, the ultimate form of fight is violent ideation or homicide. So when I saw the symptoms that the DSR affected, I saw the neighborhoods where I grew up. I thought 100% of people have this from low. You can get this from two ways. One is a blunt force trauma, where amygdala sends a signal to these nerves in your neck, the select ganglion, and you get heightened. If it's too overwhelming, you get it stays heightened. And Dr. Lipov can explain the science.
Yeah. Jamie, if I may, can I interrupt for a second?
Yes, for sure.
Yeah.
Let's talk about my favorite term, PTSI, that you're alluding to.
Okay.
So that term was developed by Dr. Frank Ogberg, very famous psychiatrist, came up with the term Stockholm Syndrome. So when we're talking about trauma And that's why you got pretty much everything correct and be better than I could say, Jamie. The only thing that I think to remember is you don't need to have a hit in the head, blunt trauma or any kind of trauma at all. You can see somebody being shot in front of you. You can get PTSD from that. So when you say PTSI, we're talking about post-traumatic stress injury. Injury means the nervous system is overactive. The amygdala is overactive, and you can actually measure it. That's why it's biologic, and that's why we're working on changing the name PTSD to PTSI. But I just want people to think that it involves physical trauma. You don't need physical trauma. If somebody ignores you or starves you, your brain is changing. That's what Ryan just say.
Yeah.
And you can actually measure it, and you can reverse it by using DSR. That's the state.
Yeah. Right? So rather than being treating something, you're fixing something. And where I was going to go from where he was saying is blunt force trauma and extreme trauma. Typically, if you have a near-death experience, you slip while going down a mountain or something and you catch yourself. Your amygdala sends a signal to these nerves in your neck, and that's what jolts you into fight or flight to save your life. Okay. Now, if that trauma is too great, and we can explain the science behind this, the system stays stuck. You never come back to baseline 5 hours later. Okay. The other thing that can cause it to get stuck, to go up and stay stuck, that's why it's a physical injury. You've changed your biology in your neck as an injury, as if you cut yourself, right? It's an injury. You've changed it through an event that's measurable biologically. And that now, those nerves are now sending false signals to your brain that fight or flight is occurring 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, 7 days a week. We break this all down in the book, okay? The other thing that causes it that I think is the more prevalent cause, the massive cause of this, people are getting stuck in fight or flight. And this is where maybe I'm contributing to the conversation. I'm not the inventor. I've been given the honor to help this guy, right? But where I think I'm contributing to the conversation is the other thing that causes this that I think is the more predominant thing causing this. I believe 40 to 50% of the US and global population have this injury in their body. Carrying allostatic load, long-term chronic stress, long-term extreme stress. Gabor Mate just came out of a book with a book called The Myth of Normal. It's a New York Times bestseller, where he's basically saying our modern society, our modern digital kind of artificial society, artificial boxes, we live in an artificial box, we go in another roving artificial box to go to another artificial box and work. We don't have all the things that mitigate against nature, the things that calm us that are in line with our evolutionary biology, right? So low level chronic stress or allostatic load, okay, like death by a thousand cuts also can cause this system, like what I experienced with poverty, okay, can cause this system to stay stuck. And you have, and a person that grows up in a neighborhood like me has the exact same 7, 8, 9 symptoms of somebody coming back from Afghanistan. And there is a host of physiological and autoimmune conditions that cascade from having an overactive sympathetic nervous system.
Makes sense. We aren't prepared biologically for these kinds of things. Our system just sees it as fight or flight. And I think, that how that cascades is really... Well, that's kind of taking all of it to the next level, right? I mean, if we start to work with other healthcare professionals to incorporate this into an overall treatment plan, right? Now we're looking at things a little more holistically. Would you say?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what I would say is even the most skeptical people that I've interviewed, I've gone around the country the last 2 years and interviewed some of the top, scientists in the world to comment on this, from Stephen Porges, Dr. Frank Ochberg, who coined the term Stockholm Syndrome, as well as post-traumatic stress injury, PTSI, Gabor Mate, Dr. Daniel Amen. I've gone around and spoken to these guys and even, and also who've been partners, but also I've talked to a lot of cynical doctors that believe that this works, but it's just another modality. And what I say to them is when I get that pushback is, okay, well, what should someone do first? Should they do MDR first? Should they do this first? And even the most cynical person that would say they do this. I've had people that have gone through sexual abuse can really struggle with EMDR, right? So there's no downside to this. There's no side effects. You're through it. 15-minute safe outpatient procedure over 1 to 2 days. And I think it's the most important medical innovation since when all the data comes in, since the discovery of penicillin in 1928, it dwarfs the polio vaccine. If you just look at how many people die from suicide every year, compared to how many people whose lives were saved from, taking the polio vaccine, when you reset the fight or flight system, the data will show that people just don't commit suicide after you do that, right? Yeah. We think it's a disorder. You have to think of it like this, back to the running from the tiger thing, okay? If you feel like you're running from a tiger 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, and you're feeling all those things, anxiety, mild paranoia, sense of doom, hypervigilance, hyperarousal, lack of sleep, hair trigger, and then the guys that come back from Afghanistan, they have ED because you can't have sex if you're running from a tiger, because that's the last thing that's going to be on your mind. Okay. And you're feeling that 24 hours. We're designed to feel that for 30 seconds and then save our life or, be consumed. Okay? we're not designed as human beings to live in that state. So if you feel that way, it's basically a description of what it feels like right before you're about to die. So if you feel like if you're sitting on your house watching Netflix, eating cottage cheese, and you're always feeling like you're about to die, you're not going to want to live if you're always feeling like you're about to die. And that's what that mechanism is. What's most interesting to me is that you can get this from distant parents. You can get this from not having a distant father, not having your emotional needs met. So you have this massive swath of the Western world doesn't ever associate themselves with trauma, that has these symptoms. They don't think anything ever happened to them, but they have these symptoms in just as an extreme way as somebody coming back from war or somebody growing up under the conditions that I have. But they're a plumber, a kindergarten teacher, a school principal, a yoga instructor. And so I think that's my message, is I want people to ask themselves if they have these symptoms, realize that they're, because I didn't realize I was uncomfortable in my body. That's how I just thought human existence was until I met Dr. Lipov, right?
So you're describing a lot of the challenges around this, right? Because a lot of it's stigmatized, tied to mental health, those kinds of things. Are there bigger, how do we overcome that? Are there bigger clinical trials happening? Dr. Lipov,
Let me answer. Well, there are a couple of things I'd like to comment on. Number one, as far as I would say, this fight and flight overreactivity is adaptive from our past, right? So the problem is we live in a different type of environment. Mm-hmm. I was interviewed once and they were saying, well, it's not as bad as it used to be being chased by a tiger. I would say it's probably much worse now because you can't even move. You're sitting here absorbing stress. What happens in your body is a fight and flight transmitters in the brain, norepinephrine, increases and it stays that way. That's the problem. But as far as how do we go forth, there are two specific plans, plus number of plans. Number one, I think Jamie's and I book is kind of beginning to talk to the layperson. So it's designed to give specific examples, but as Jamie would say, it's sciencey enough that keeps people interested. If people are really interested in the science aspect of it, that's kind of, I would say, my job. I can give it papers and explanations. So stigma of mental health is one thing. Biological proof is another, right? That's two different things. So let me tell you what we're doing. First of all, my mother was under care of a psychiatrist when I was a surgical intern when she killed herself. So I'm very interested in that aspect of it. So as far as changing it, in fact, we just have a PSA that's being made right now. We're going to try to distribute it far and wide that talks about, and we should have it available in about a week. So basically it talks about the name PTSD needs to be changed to PTSI. Thankfully, Dr. Arkberg is still around and he's willing to help us promote that. So the end of the PSA ends with the following. So change the name, remove the stigma, save lives. That's the message. That's it. It's very simple.
What,
so that's one.
Yeah, correct.
Number two, sciencey stuff. So you can say whatever you like, but what's the sciencey stuff show? There was one study that was done through the military, through Fort Bragg, Schippler, and Lenchheim in Germany. It was a reasonable study, not the best, I would say, but it was okay, and it showed some good results. But they go, yeah, it's not convincing enough. Mm. One of the problems with DSR or SGB is that there's no way to do placebo. Right. Most of the trial people are used to, right? You take a pill, you take a sugar pill, you can't tell the difference.
Right, right.
When you do the block and your eye is droopy, which is Horner syndrome, you can tell the difference, right? Mm-hmm. So there's no way to do a placebo. So the conventional approach just doesn't work.
Right,
so
right.
How do we get around that? The only way to get around it is to do advanced scanners, functional MRI or PET scan. There was one study done in North Long Beach, California, VA, where they did PET scan before and after stellate, and they demonstrate deactivation of amygdala. Amygdala overactivation is considered diagnostic for PTSD. There was an amazing funder. They gave us enough money to actually do the study the way it should be done. I designed it, but it's being done by NYU, so I'm not touching that. So NYU, you know, big institution, I think it's unimpeachable, whatever the results will come back. So they're doing an fMRI first, functional MRI. We're doing other sciencey stuff. We're doing the DSR. Then we do the fMRI after. So the idea is that we'll show convincingly with a big enough of a number, objectively, what's happening in the brain. I think once that's done, that's going to change all the perspective. Because you can run around and say, this is real, this is not real. You know, there's debate. But if you have fMRI, like if somebody has a broken leg and you have a cast on and 6 months later, the people with casts, their legs healed, the ones without casts didn't heal, there's no place to go for critique, right? That's in about 2 years, hopefully the data will be out and then we'll be able to do this.
There's already a lot of data because the Army study, the Navy study. But, you know, to answer, I'd like to kind of to refer back to your question, Kelly, of, you know, it's kind of how, you know, what's the resistance or how do you parse it out? I'm going to answer part of it, and then I'd like Dr. Litbob to answer the second part of it. But the first part of that answer, it's such a great question, is the biggest barrier that he's run into. And it's hard for me to even say that because what he's done in 20 years, considering what the implications for the innovation are, how far he's gotten in 20 years is astonishing. Max Planck, a Nobel laureate from the 1940s, said that medical innovation is one in funerals. You have to wait for your opponents to die. So as much as this should be as popular as Botox and Latex, considering how ubiquitous it is in our society, it should be as popular as LASIK. And what he's done in 20 years is incredible. It's not ubiquitous, right? And the reason for that is it's been collapsed with other modalities when it's not other modalities. It gets collapsed with EMDR, and it's completely different. It's the fundamental reset that you should do first, and then those things go way, way better because there's some incredible modalities out there. Yeah. So that's been the biggest barrier is it's being mixed in with, you know, equine therapy, petting ponies, right? Mm-hmm. And when it's its own thing. And then the second thing is it's incredible to believe. You know, he's not going near the brain. You could scan the brain on an fMRI with an fMRI with somebody that had distant parents. So they're and you would see overactivity in their amygdala. No one ever touched them. They don't think they have trauma. You could do the DSR over 2 days, scan their brain again, and the overactivity in the amygdala is calmed down. And you'd likely see increased blood flow to the frontal cortex. We didn't go near the brain. We just went to these nerves in the neck that are lying to the brain. But I would like Dr. Litbob to share, I think the other biggest thing is, I think, a really good metaphor for why people, and the whole point of the book is to rip away the barriers and use art and storytelling and science to bring this to the masses, to bring this to the world, to make this a, you know, Kleenex and a Coke, something that, because if 50% of the population has it, and I can show you how I can get to those numbers, that means all of us either have it or are dealing with 50 people that have it. You know, like we're surrounded by people that are exhibiting these symptoms. And so, I think Dr. Lipov could, I'd like Dr. Lipov to tell the story of Semmelweis, because I think Semmelweis is a really good explanation as to why it hasn't been embraced and why we've had to write a book and put it in every Barnes and Noble in America to finally get this to be known in the world.
All right. Well, there are two answers I'd like to put in there. Number one is that one of my buddies, who's a big professor, basically said, you have a credulity problem. It's hard to believe it's such a simple solution to such a complex issue. And then people have been doing this procedure since 1926. Why did you figure it out as opposed to nobody else? It's a credulity issue. And I give him an answer and go, yeah, whatever, move on. Anyway, so Jamie brings down one of my favorite physicians, kind of cautionary tale. So this is a gentleman who was born in Hungary, and he, in 1876, I believe, was starting to practice medicine, obstetrical medicine, in Vienna, which was the highlight of medical system in its day. He noticed that when women delivered babies in a hospital, their chance of death was three times higher compared to doing it at home with midwives. So he said, I don't know what it is, but it's happening. So he published on that, of course, gets ignored. Then he followed around the doc. Turns out the doctors used to dissect dead people, do autopsies, and run over to deliver babies. And it's day, nobody knew about germ theory, because this is before Leeuwenhoek, before they could actually look at germs and stuff like that. And the belief was, if anything smelled putrid, then that's how the disease were transmitted, by bad smells, bad humor, actually.
In the air.
In the air, whatever. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so that was the thinking. So he published on that. He goes to the doctor, said, this is the research. I published on that. He writes a book about it. He shows it.
What year are we? What is this? Is this 17, 18, 19th century?
1876, I believe.
Okay.
Something like that. That area. So then he goes, then you'd think the doctors go, okay, that makes perfect sense. No, you'd be wrong on that. So what they did is they go, you're accusing us of being filthy. That is totally unacceptable. You're totally wrong. They put him in a psych ward, and he was beaten to death within a month of admission in a psych ward.
For telling people to wash their hands.
Yeah.
Hold on. It gets better. Yeah, exactly. That's precisely what. So then 20 years later, Lister figures out germ theory. Like Listerine, that's all his big thing.
Yeah.
So after that, the medical establishment goes, oh my God, we have to wash our hands. We're transmitting germs. We shouldn't be dissecting dead bodies, getting all the bugs from them and putting it in the women, and they're dying of fevers after they deliver babies. And they termed this physician Leeuwenhoek, or whichever way you pronounce it, savior of babies, posthumously. So what I was telling Jamie when he and I met is that I'm so happy. Number one, I'm not a psych ward. Number two, I'm glad I wasn't beaten to death in a psych ward. Number three, I'm still functioning and here. And actually, we're getting momentum and we're actually able to hook up. You know, I'm now a medical director of Stella. We have 35 sites in the United States, other countries, locations. So I think we are well on our way to bypass this poor gentleman's thing. And I think will have a significant impact. So that's kind of my answer to that.
No, I love it. That's very positive, because that's, you know, so evolution into the future. I mean, just continue to spread the word, get it through the trials. I mean, obviously there's some element of the medical establishment who, of course,
we're not
discussed, right? Like,
hold on, if I may, Jamie, I'm sorry. Yeah, are you asking what's going to happen? What's going to happen in our future? Was that your question?
Yeah, that's where I'm going with my brand.
Let me give you an answer. I'm kind of a dreamer, right?
And then I want to comment on this one. Okay,
of course. But I think you want to hear what I'm going to put in my dream here first.
Okay.
Yeah.
So number one, we're going to treat a lot more people. Number two, hopefully our book is a success and more people will become more cognizant of this. Number three, I just got IRB approval, like for a real study. So my collaborator is UCLA. University. So I believe in about a year, we'll be able to prove pretty definitively that you can reverse aging by using this procedure. Let me tell you what I mean by that and how you're going to prove it. So if you look at the aging speed of special forces, they age quicker than people who are not involved in this horrible battle. Right? You can measure that. If you look up something called Grim Age, it's a term for epigenetic clocks. It was designed by Dr. Harworth originally, regardless. So you can take my word for it. There is a way to be able to tell how fast somebody is aging. Okay. The reason you want to know that is because if you're aging faster than normal, you're going to die sooner. And you can actually predict people's death by epigenetic clock. I believe our treatment reverses epigenetic clock's advancement. So that's kind of, I think, a near-term future. But go ahead, Jamie.
What I would like to say, and one of the reasons why I was incredibly excited about being on this show, because it's different than any other show we're doing in the sense that it's discussing advancements in life sciences through a business lens, right? And it requires business to propagate something on a wide scale. I told Dr. Lip when we first met that I'm not altruistic. I saw what this was and how important it was. And that, you know, in certain ways serves me. Yeah, as an artist, you know, if you're going to be an artist and you have to decide what you're going to work on, are you going to work on this thing that's important that has ramifications all over the world? Or are you just going to go work on a pretty picture? Right. So it wasn't really altruistic for me, but what was the deciding factor? And this kind of goes to your show, Kelly. What was the deciding factor in terms of my decision to kind of not do other work and focus on this is the fact is around 3.5 years ago, about a year and a half or 2 years before I met Dr. Lipov, he teamed up with Sterling Partners, a multi-billion-dollar private equity firm in Chicago to open up the Stella Center, to open up these clinics all over the United States. These are the only clinics in the world that have all of the protocols that Dr. Lipov has, made this 85 to 90% effective in the permanent relief of post-traumatic stress. So if you want to get this done, you don't just go and get this anywhere. You should go to a Stella Center. It lasts longer and it's far more efficacious. When I had my first conversation talking to Daniel Amen about this, he was very leery. And I said, Daniel, you know, I really would just like you to look at the research and then tell me if I'm full of crap. And we were on a Zoom call and he said, hold on. He started looking, his mouth kind of fell open as he was talking to me. And he didn't even want to be on that call. And now he's our partner. He said, wow. And I said, what? He said, Jamie, there's a very credible study here that says this is 70% effective in the permanent relief of most extreme post-traumatic stress syndromes. And I said, that's an old paper. It's 10 years old. We're at 85 or 90 now with the modern Stella protocols. Okay.
Yeah.
And nice. Daniel Amen said to me, the most famous psychiatrist in America, who's been the leader of saying that mental wellness is biological and far less mentally and disordery and amorphous and unscientific than we think. Mm-hmm. And the data science, he's got over 200,000 brain scans and last scans, which is a massive data set in the last 10 years. The data science has really proven him right. He looks at me through the Zoom and he says, Jamie, I said, it's 85%. He said it was the study said 70. He said, Jamie, you don't understand. It's 70%. This wins the Nobel Prize. That's what we've come across here. I'll help you. And that started off, you know, a year-long, a two-year partnership where we were scanning our patients in Amen clinics, treating them with the DSR over 1 to 2 days and scanning them less than 24 hours later. And what we saw, what the forensic psychiatrists saw on those brain scans after 2 days would be something you would see equivalent to 6 months of hyperbaric, right? So one thing. One of the things I would love for Dr. Lipov to comment on, you know, one of the things people often ask me about when we're talking about this book, The Invisible Machine, which is bringing this to pop culture. That's my contribution. It's science. It's a pop science book, like something Carl Sagan would do or the China Study or, you know, it's a science book that everyone can read, right? Okay. What's the point of keeping science from the masses, right? That we're trying to bring science to the masses. But one of the things that we talk about extensively in the book, and I would love for Dr. Lipov to comment on this, because this is one of the things that I'm probably most fascinated with, is, okay, so you have this book, The Body Keeps the Score. All right, well, how does the body keep the score? If we're damaging the body through trauma, even if no one touches you, what is happening in the body? What's keeping score? What's doing the damage? So one of the things that I would love for Dr. Lipov to comment on is, why does having an overactive sympathetic nervous system stuck in fight or flight for a year, 10 years, 20 years, what exactly does that do to the body? Does it affect, is it giving us cancer? Is it giving us autoimmune disease? Is it, you know, is there a health threat? Is it giving us orthopedic problems? What are the physical consequences of living for 10 years with an overactive sympathetic nervous system?
Okay, so that's a very reasonable question. I think it's a very broad question. So first of all, what's interesting is PTSD is heritable, meaning if you have a grandfather that was involved in World War II, the chance of the grandchild, the granddaughter, having PTSD is significantly higher compared to someone who doesn't have that type of grandfather, which is, to me, is mind-blowing. So the whole thing about epigenetic drift that we talked about, that's all from trauma. But it also has a mental change. So it is well known that somebody has PTSD, the chance of heart attack is twice as high compared to
PTSI, post-traumatic stress injury, right?
Okay. I'm using, thank you, I appreciate it.
Okay.
Yeah.
PTSI. Somebody has PTSI, that chance of developing cardiovascular problems significantly higher. Turns out that's overactive sympathetic system over dysregulates immune system. So that means the chance of number of immune-related disorders like ulcerative colitis and things like that can happen.
What about cancer?
Could you mind give me a second?
Oh, yes. Yes, doctor.
You get that, man.
Yes, doctor. All right, I'll shut up.
Thank you.
We're like anyway. Martin and Lewis, right?
I know. All right, awesome. Let the man talk.
Okay.
Anyway, thank you. Anyway, so what happens, the reason people do not develop cancer, cancerous cells happen all the time in all of us, but we have scavenging system, which is the immune system that kills the cancers. If the immune system is being suppressed by overactive sympathetic system, then the cancers can take root and grow, right? Further, when somebody has PTSI, their norepinephrine levels in the brain increase. That's been measured in human beings, no question. So I wrote a chapter about sexual impact of PTSI. Turns out norepinephrine, there could be three levels. Low, there's no sexual interest. Optimal, great sexual interest. Too much, no sexual interest. Actually, too much norepinephrine suppresses sexual interest, at least in males, and sexual function. Up to 85% of men with PTSI or PTSD have sexual dysfunction. So if you put it all together, then the other thing we know is PTSI alters sleep cycles markedly. So DSR actually reverses that. What's interesting, the recent data shows that when somebody has a bad sleep, that leads to other problems, high blood pressure, other things, early death. But what's also interesting, turns out that there are five stages of sleep. Deep sleep is one of the stages. The most important part of sleep is deep sleep, because turns out what it does, that's when the poisons which are developed during the day gets cleared out of the brain. If you never get in deep sleep, the poisons truly stay in the brain. And that's not good for the brain. Leads to increased chance of dementia and other things. So in summary, overactive sympathetic system produces cardiovascular effects, immune function, no debate. Likely increases cancer risk, definitely produces sexual dysfunction, definitely produces sleep dysfunction. Just a few things.
Definitely.
Probably more about the other.
No, and we're we're running a bit on time here, so we'll have to start to bring this to a close. Unfortunately, I'd love to keep going, but again, I just want to come back to this idea of the holistic approach and how getting this out of the shadows, as you guys have described, bringing it more mainstream. You know, Jamie, not that I ever love anyone's trauma, but I love your story of overcoming that and then bringing this all together and really starting to use that as a platform going forward to try to bring some realistic, and holistic change to, as you're sitting here thinking about different friends and some of the issues I know they're experiencing physically. And I have a friend in chronic pain and she has a similar growing up story to yours. So I'm definitely going to send her your direction to check out the book and hopefully maybe look around and see what we can do to continue to bring that forward. I guess last quick question, and these got to be quick answers. If you could go back in time, if you could go back in time and tell yourself something at the beginning of your career, what would you tell yourself, Jamie?
Wow.
I know. Quick answer.
Okay. Quick answer is the reason I was in the position to see this in a more broad way is because I went from extreme poverty and semi-literacy to graduating from, a data school, the Stonington School of Economics, in just over 5 years. So I went from one extreme to another, the poorest people in the world, the worst circumstances in the world, to the wealthiest people in the world in a very short period of time. What I would tell myself is it's biological. It's a broken leg you can't see. The mental condition, like I would have started with what's wrong with us is physical damage to our bodies that's now completely fixable. There's no reason to live like that. And there's a thing called, the last best thing I'll say is a thing called operator syndrome, which people get from having the stress of war, even if they're never in a firefight. It's identical to what you'd have if you grew up in poverty. And there's a cascade of physical effects that come from it, from orthopedic problems, chronic pain, whatever. So I would be only looking at biology. That's what I would be doing, not going down a rabbit hole of self-help and other things that I did in my life. Yeah.
Gotcha. Thanks for that, Dr. Lipoff. How about you? What would you tell yourself if you could go back in time?
I would say, my brother calls me BB, Brother Bulldog, because I'm one persistent individual.
Yeah.
And basically be persistent and follow the science where it goes and help the people, which is, I've tried to live, both of my parents were physicians, my brother is a physician. So I honor my parents' memories, especially my mother's who killed herself, and just keep doing what you're doing and help as many people as you can. Hopefully everything else will work out.
I love that. I think we're going to have to talk about maybe a part two. We'll have to revisit some of these conversations and see where you guys have made it forward.
I would love it.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us.
This was an amazing, amazing interview, Kelly. Thank you. Really, really. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of From Lab to Launch, brought to you by Qualio. If you like what you've heard, please subscribe and give the show a positive review. It really helps us out. For more information about Qualio, our guest today, or to be a guest on a future episode, please refer to the show notes. Until next time.